Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world. Welcome back to the Center for Internet Security's podcast series, Cybersecurity Where You Are, where we tackle some of the most interesting challenges of our industry, but also talk to some of the most interesting people in the industry. And this is a special occasion here, talking to someone who he claims to be winding down his career, but there's no evidence of that yet. My old friend, Phil Reitinger. Phil, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tony. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure, Phil. And, you know, we've worked together for a lot of years, but I started digging through notes and finding your bios online. I thought, oh my gosh, I only knew about half of what this guy did during his career. You've covered about as much ground in this industry as anybody I know. But how did you get started in it?
It's hard to keep a job.
Well, I wasn't going to go there, but since you brought it up, right? It's either a sign of your restless soul who needs a new challenge every couple of years, or just can't hold a job. But how did you get started in this? Because, I mean, when you were started, this was may have been in before pre-cyber, before we use words like that.
Yeah, it was during the InfoSec era. So, I mean, the way it all sort of started is I was a computer science and electrical engineering undergrad student. And so, and most of that was even the electrical engineering was on the digital side. So I was primarily in programming. Like my senior project, I wrote a fourth interpreter in 6502 assembly code.
Another reason to admire you. I would say fourth is the only programming language I could claim any expertise in. So you're my hero.
So after that, I went to law school for, you know, unknown reasons. And I, with sort of the thought that I was going to be like a patent lawyer or something.
Okay.
And I went to law school in the Northeast, and I, knowing that pretty much all the patent law work was in the New York City area, I quickly decided that was not for me because okay. It was just too cold. And so I went out, I did a bunch of different things, but I ended up at the Department of Justice doing civil litigation. And I found about this thing called the Computer Crime Unit in the General Litigation and Legal Advice section. And I wanted to work there. This was in the 90s. I started stalking the person who had the section. Well, actually, it was just a unit then, Scott Charney, and harassed him Wow. until he eventually hired me as the number six prosecutor in that in 1995. And right. I've been so doing resume, it full-time since 95.
Resume includes cyber stalker. let the record show. Wow. And so, but who are the kind of folks that were in there? So obviously, Scott is a well-known character here, but
well, Scott,
who are the kind of folks that graduated that work?
Yeah, Marty Stansel-Gam mm-hmm. were both there at the time. Mm-hmm. Lots of other people joined. David Green, Mark Eckenweiler, Mark Zwillinger, Jessica Herrera Flanagan. I mean, the CSIPS mafia, because it became the computer crime and intellectual property section, is yeah. pretty broad. Megan Stiefel went through
wow.
there.
Yeah.
Chris Painter.
Sure.
You know, the number of people who are in cybersecurity who spent some time there is broad.
Yeah, I mean that, and you know, that's a bit of a who's who for folks, you know, still current in the industry. And did many of them come with some, so you had a pretty strong technical background there for someone that is.
I was one of the more technical people. Mm-hmm. One of the few, I would say, with, you know, sort of formal training, if you will. But a lot of the people were, you know, for Charney, Scott Charney, for example, you know, his father was a programmer and, he'd been doing tech stuff his whole life. And then, you know, Mark Eckenweiler, you probably know Mark. Right. Mark was a classics major. Right. But he'd been, you know, at the internet from the very start and was doing things with domains. And so, you know, everybody who was there because they loved it.
Yeah. And you know, those were kind of wild and woolly times. Right. Every investigation, every prosecution was had to be a first of. Any other lessons learned from that first experience?
Well, I mean, there are certainly lots of lessons learned, in retrospect. What I'd say is it remains shocking to me how little is new, given how much has changed. The same types of issues we saw then are the issues we see today. It's just, there's been more automation, more moving forward, but, exploiting trust, failures in authentication, difficulty in keeping software up to date, all of those things that were around then are around now. It's just, it's old wine in new bottles.
Yeah. And I have that same feeling also, Phil. And it's I went back to look at a talk I gave in 2004, where there's a slide sort of characterizing the state of play. And I look at it and go, wow, I have two reactions. Yeah, that held up pretty good. And then the second reaction is, I don't think we've solved any of these problems yet. And I don't think it's just, old guy on the street corner, howling at the wind, but it really feels like these fundamentals have not changed.
Yeah, it's been... I like to say, and we've talked about this before, Tony, I like to say I've been in this meeting before. And it's rare I can't be in a meeting and say I've been in this meeting before. So little is new. Now, I think a lot of progress has been made, but the fundamental problems are still the fundamental problems. And we're still facing a situation where the level of commitment that everyone shows to cybersecurity, particularly governments and large, companies that say it's super important to them, doesn't match what they say about the importance of the issue.
Yeah. I pulled a quote from somewhere in your past year. We all know what we have to do. It's just the will to get things completed, right? That's lacking. And that feels about right. And it's not it tells you something about both the sort of complexity and the amorphous nature of the problem, but also this is more about political will or prioritization than it is about technology, right? We keep waiting for the magic thing to save us, but I don't think that doesn't seem to be on the horizon, at least not for the last 40 plus years. So what did your next steps, right? So you were there in the early days of the government and the legal view of security. What was next for you? Was it Microsoft?
It was soon after that. But I was at the computer crime section until 2001.
Okay.
No, 2000. And then I went over to DOD for about a year.
Oh, okay. DC3 maybe?
Right. I ran the DOD cyber center. So I was the first executive director there. And I left that. I know you as a longtime DOD person, I will tell you quite honestly that DOD was not for me. It just was a very different culture than I was used to. And
Understood.
I left and I went to Microsoft then. So I rejoined, the person, as I said, I stalked before to get to the computer crime unit was Scott Charney. He'd left DOJ while I was still there and then had gone to PwC, but then went from PwC to be like the chief security officer, I forget what his official title was, but he handled cybersecurity and cybersecurity policy for Microsoft. And he recruited me to leave DOD and go there. So I was there for 6 years after that.
So what did you learn being on the inside of the big IT company that, in terms of these unsolvable problems or how the nature of the problem that we're all trying to solve?
Well, everybody's got constraints. I think I would say that private sector companies have a lot of agility. But at the end of the day, they're designed to be driven by economic motivation, right? They're businesses, right? And so I saw lots of good people in Microsoft, many, many good people that I still am friends with, for whom, Scott among them, Craig Mundy, the CTO of Microsoft among them, for whom the public interest was a huge driver. But it remained the fact at the end of the day, the company had to make money. And so that puts constraints on what they do. So, you know, I think one of the things I would say I took from that is the problems are actually pretty similar between government and industry. And second, you know, how important it is, and this is not a pro-regulation or an anti-regulation point, but how important it is for policymakers in government, Congress, et cetera, to set a framework up that incentivizes the right actions. Because if you set that up right, the right things will happen. It's the wonderful thing that you and I've talked about metrics many times, right? People respond to metrics. And the thing about metrics is good metrics incentivize good action, and bad metrics incentivize bad action. You know, and that's true whether you're in government or industry or the nonprofit sector.
No, you're exactly right. And that your observation, right, but once you were inside the big IT machinery that is Microsoft. And I've known many of those folks, you know, for Microsoft, yourself included, and you know, great human beings, good Americans, good citizens, best of intentions, but they're juggling a lot of things. And I know you got from the government side this, there could be some naivety about that business model, right? Well, they should just fix it. Well, you know, or people would say, I sometimes joke, Phil, some of the most ridiculous things I've heard in cybersecurity came out of the mouths of really smart government people. Why don't we just write our own patches for Microsoft software? We can't trust those guys. Do you have any idea the machinery of, you know, software maintenance, software testing, regression testing? No, we're not doing that. That is not going to happen. And so you have to look at this balance. But the incentive parts, and this is one of the central themes I know of your career. What's your do something, measure it? You know, those kinds of taglines. You have been absolutely consistent in that. And you're exactly right. But it takes careful thought, right? You can't say, give me better security. There has to be some clarity, but there also has to be some measurement of progress, right? We have to know where the parties are and to account for the economics. You know, one of my taglines in my career field is economics always wins. You know, we can stand on the rock solid ground of good intentions and national security, but that can't change behavior, certainly not in the long run. And we really have to account for that.
You know, I would say, Tony, one of the other things I took from that was, I think, the first time, and this associated with, you know, you and I started to do some work together, both when I was at DHS, right? But, you know, around things like the security content automation protocol, right? I became convinced early this millennium that the problem for cybersecurity was scale. It has always been scale, and it will always be scale. How do you get things done at scale, given the problems of code and repeatability and use? And you know, Microsoft shows that as well as anybody else, right? Because if there's one thing they've got, it's scale. And governments face that all the time because they're having to deal with entire economies or even, you know, the global internet. And so that's it always, in some way or other, for the hardest problems, comes back to scale.
Yeah, I think that's right on the money, Phil. And so you took the experience from Microsoft, and that's when you went to DHS, right, to NPPD. And we got to work more closely than at that point. And you know, you were the first. I think I forget the exact title of it, the ecosystem paper from your time at NPPD. It's still one of the forgotten treasures of this industry, because it was really an earnest and thoughtful attempt to look at the entire ecosystem, right, as one body, not a series of disconnected either regulatory things or technical ideas and so forth. You know, the notion is that this is about an information-centric enterprise that is really very dynamic, but has to be seen in the whole before you can take action.
Yep. It's another example of how sort of, you know, things never change. And a lot of people, you know, that drew from ideas from you, Bruce McConnell, who mm-hmm. was from, great. Who joined me at DHS for a while and was at OMB before that. You know, there were a lot of people, MITRE ended up doing most of the work writing the paper. But it was, the notion of this ecosystem and how we move forward security on an ecosystem level is inherently about scale. and you know, the problems like authentication and automation, they resound again to this day.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, we're going to take a short break for the audience here for a message. We'll be right back. Happy 25 years, CIS. Back in 2000, a bunch of experts from government, academia, and private industry met at the Cosmos Club in DC.
Their mission was clear: help local communities, businesses, government, and critical infrastructure defend against cyber threats, regardless of budget or expertise.
CIS was born to fulfill that mission.
So, Tony, how have we done so far?
Well, let's take a look at the numbers. We detected and mitigated close to 320,000 cyber events, protecting public and private sector organizations.
We also blocked over 3 trillion potential connections to known malicious, suspicious, or otherwise risky sites in defense of critical infrastructure.
In 2024 alone, our guides received 1.5 million downloads for their straightforward, actionable security guidance.
And let's not forget 150 episodes of Cybersecurity Where You Are.
Certainly unforgettable, of course not. And honestly, Sean, that's just the beginning.
Absolutely. It's been an incredible 25 years, and we're just getting started.
The future of cybersecurity is evolving fast, and so are we at CIS.
We may not have all the answers yet,
but we've got the right people, the right mission, and a global community behind us.
So here's to the next 25 years of innovation, collaboration, and impact.
Join us on the journey at cisecurity.org. Hey, Phil, I want to come back now to that point you were making about scale, right? And I think one of the things you recognized when you pulled that study together in the paper was it's a kind of a scale you have to build in a distributed fashion, right? There's no one vendor. There's no one policymaker that gets to decide that. And thinking about the complexity of sort of the technical issues, the machinery, the movement of data here and there, and then how it gets used, and our understanding of the fidelity of it, right? In that kind of environment, you know, authentication is everything. You have to be able to, I don't take action unless I have confidence in it. And so some of that, you mentioned some of the NIST work in the security content automation protocols. Some of it came true, but it never quite hit the scale, right? The thing that really applied to you. Did we miss the mark there, or what are the barriers to the?
Well, we're still struggling toward it, Tony, I think. You know, I'm more happy about the things that happen in authentication than in most areas. You know, there's been considerable progress with, mm-hmm. you know, FIDO and a lot of the other work, the rolling out of pass keys. Mm-hmm. There's continuing progress there. You know, the notion of automation, we continue to see more and more automation. And I think, you know, AI is accelerating that. The biggest challenges, I think, fall in, for me, you know, the third, I have 3 prongs for scale. And the third prong is interoperability, right? And, you know, yeah, we get progress there, but it's at best 2 steps forward and 1 step back. And, you know, everybody wants to build their own silos. You know, even the people that work with open source want to build their proprietary silos with open source. They just want to build the, you know, the silo out of something else. They're trying to build their walled garden in a sense. And, you know, we've never really, the idea of that paper, which is, you know, we talked a little about it, but it's about automated collective defense. Mm-hmm. Because you know, what really drives all of the only way we're all going to be successful, and the only thing that defenders really have in their favor is the amount of the internet that is still good, right? And so the ability to gather information, gather intelligence, especially with automation, this is something we're saying, as I said, back in the aughts, it really could drive action on a scale where it's not everybody defending themselves, it's an ecosystem defending itself. But that requires interoperability built in from the start. And that's never really happened. It's gotten better, but only a little better, I think.
I think that third point of yours is really true. And it is still a struggle today. Yeah, some of those technology issues, you know, the identification and so forth, have really gotten better. But you're right. At the time when I thought that sort of late aughts, 2010-ish, 2011-ish, was really one of the high points of the industry, I think. I think back to it and say, yep, there were some high water marks there. But what it took was, relatively speaking, a handful of people who agreed on this bigger common vision of an ecosystem, right? And you're convincing competitors essentially to give something up, right? Sort of their own cylinder of excellence. I don't use silos. I go to the cylinders of excellence and their ability to lock customers into, a particular way of behavior that makes it expensive for them to leave. And so we're asking people, for a greater good to take action against their direct immediate interest in favor of this collective defense. And that was an excellent term. It was the earliest I remember that, where it's not just let's be nice to each other, right? And we'll throw some indicators at each other every once in a while. We are, in fact, engaged in a collective, which means information from lots of places, a whole infrastructure of trust, and the triggers for action. So I haven't given up on the dream, but I think, I would agree with you. There was a lot more we could have done. But at that time, it really took a handful, I think, of people to have that story.
I will say, it's easier in some places than others, right? So two of the factors that I think really drive the ability to collaborate and interoperate are the extent to which you're interdependent and the extent to which you compete on security, right? So like the best place to try and build collaboration is in financial services. And that's because, you saw this with the success of the FS-ISAC, right? And that part of that had to do with the fact that the Treasury Department was really forward leaning, through people like Brian Peretti, to get people to come together to be in the FS-ISAC. But the financial services companies recognize that when there's a security incident, it hurts them all, right? And so they don't compete on security. They all want the internet, for the most part, to be as secure as possible. And so that's an environment built for collaboration. IT platforms, Microsoft, Apple, Google, that's more of a challenge, right? Because they're competing based on security.
Yeah, that's a great observation. I think you're right. The dynamics depend upon the position that you're in. What you see is your competitive advantage there. But I think, again, it will take some mix of, collective action, but also a collective vision, right? That will come from not just the federal government, but, enough people in the industry and nonprofits, et cetera, to take us there. So let's jump quick. So post-DHS, what was your path then?
After DHS, I was the CISO at Sony for about 3 years. And after that, I knocked around for about a year doing consulting and stuff like that before I became the CEO of the Global Cyber Alliance.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of brought us back into the same domain, and we've really enjoyed the chance to reconnect on all this. So to to the nonprofit space. I mean, you have covered as much ground as anybody I know, Phil. And with legal, technical, public, private, et cetera. So I know that. And at Global Cyber, you hit kind of an interesting mix, right, of direct services, but also I'll call it the ecosystem advocacy, how do I organize lots of people who don't work for me in the same direction? What was your initial focus there? And what were you?
Well, it's, the focus mostly hasn't changed. Now, the projects have changed. And just so your readers know, I stepped down as the CEO of the Global Cyber Alliance in September. So I'm still working part-time, sort of a senior advisor, and especially on the biggest initiative I'm involved in these days, which is Common Good Cyber. But Brian Cute is the CEO there now. But the focus was always, I became convinced around the turn of the millennium that the challenge was going to be scale, and how do we practically solve problems at scale? I told before, about my maxims about I've been in this meeting before, and to measure it, do something, measure it came out of that. That was the early tagline for GCA, still is effectively. But how do we actually try and solve problems like DMARC? you know, like fishing. And so, you know, the, one of the big projects we did early on was we built Quad 9 with the Packet Clearinghouse, which is, you know, a global protective DNS service, which, you know, even to this day will get people's eyes to fog over because they don't know what a protective DNS service is.
Right.
But, you know, it was the, it was, I think, the first real attempt, and a hugely successful one. It's still out there serving hundreds of millions of people, to build a protective DNS service that provides enterprise class security protection to people free of charge while also protecting their privacy through just a sort of a different model. And you know, the it is one of the most cost-effective things that anyone can do. So I think, you know, that one took off. The problem right now is that, you know, while there are places around the world where the protective DNS service, like Australia, is the norm and probably becoming the norm in the UK, there are places like the UK where it is not. I'm sorry, where the UK is, but the US it is not, right? Because people just haven't been able to pull the levers and say, how do we make this, how do we make this everywhere? And it's not hard to do. It takes a smidgen of political will. And that's all.
Yeah, and it's so foundational, right? That you think, we can't get this. What? How are we going to deal with something more complicated, expensive, subtle, etc.? But you're right. It's that message, and taking this serious look at what are the, I'll call it, infrastructure things that we shouldn't ask individual enterprises to solve, but really need to be solved at scale. That is, you know, clearly the kind of strategic thinking that I think is often missing in our industry.
You know, and GCA's focus was always, you know, more on the how do we actually build something, although it would go all the way up to the policy space. It's just we tended not to tackle the pure policy problems because sometimes those can be intractable. So I'll throw out one idea that I've shared with a few people before.
Sure.
Why don't we simply say that if you are offering a service and, you know, controlling data or providing things that have economic value, and you use single factor authentication, you're strictly liable for any harms that come from a failure of authentication. Just that one thing, simple. All you got to do to get around it is have some form of a stronger authentication. Pass keys, whatever, won't hold you liable for any errors on the back end. But if data gets taken, because you use one-factor authentication, and it actually is valuable, right? It's not just, you know, you're signing on to some news website that's throwing spam at you. Overnight, everybody would have MFA. And within a few months, people would be solving the interoperable scale problem because suddenly it's a big deal.
Yeah. You know, and for it's fast. Those kinds of issues, Phil, right? This has been the history of our industry. You actually get pushback from all sides, right? Oh, we don't have the will. We don't want to be unfriendly to businesses, blah, blah, blah. Then you get the security wizard view. Well, that's not nearly good enough. You know, you're not good, Bob. And, you know, we've been fighting ourselves on these kinds of things, right? So you and I both take, and we do that at CIS also, you know, this, hey, I'll take an 80% agreement, 80% solution over 25% or zero where we are today, right? It's nuts to hold ourselves back in seeking perfection. There is no mythical state of security. There's just management of the risk as we go along here.
But yeah, the right. Downside of being as old as you and I are, we're like I feel for Philip Rivers, right, who just went back at age 44
yes!
to be a quarterback right. in the NFL. I was like,
great.
Somebody posted online, I think, they're going to kill Peepaw, which I still laugh about. But it's like the old guy on the porch saying, well, that's not going to work. And here's why. No, but have at it. Go try to solve that, and that's not going to work either, because you bear the scars of all of these efforts that didn't go anywhere or were not ultimately successful because it was just too hard and the political will wasn't there.
Yeah, no, I think that's right, and unfortunately, there's a lot of that, and I see that as, I'll call it, friction within our machinery. Right? It's not, these are not more clever bad guys than we know how to deal with. And these are not exotic, you know, nuanced threat reports that we haven't seen yet. This is just the machinery of getting defenses in place. And I think it's been a shame that we cannot, you know, sort of get that collective view, right, in enough the heads of policymakers, you know, people that can influence the ecosystem. So Phil, in the interest of time, we're going to wrap this up. I'd love to have you come back so we can talk a little bit about some of the future things. And I want to make sure that I get your real perspective on this, because you and I both know lots of people who are, frankly, terrible at retiring. Folks like Steve Lipner and other friends from the early days of this business. So I need to get your perspective, because I'm approaching that date also. And I, as near as I can tell, you're still as visible and active as ever. So we'll chat a little about what might be next for folks like us, and how do we, if we want to still contribute, how can we do that? But also, when is it time for us to hang it up and move on to the next thing? So any last thought you'd care to leave with the group today?
No, I sort of a lead in or a tease if we do have a chance to talk again. I will say one of the reasons I decided to step out of the CEO role is I've been doing it for 10 years. And I think new people make things better. People, you know, despite what I said about, you know, new people coming in and saying, you know, not going to fund this or not going to do that, right? You know, it takes energy. And I remember somebody, this was years ago when I was in the government, somebody in the intelligence side said, government is a young person's game. They actually said government is a young man's game, but, you know, okay. We're going to update that to say it's a young person's game. And it takes energy. It takes passion. And I'm happy to offer advice, but it's time for new people to step in. People who look like America and look like the world and can come in with new ideas and say, you know, we're going to tackle this. And so what I'd like to spend most of my time doing is, like, I'm chairing a strategic advisory committee now, is doing that and just sort of helping other people along, helping people bring careers forward, getting them in the best space so they can achieve things, because, you know, that's the way you actually make the biggest difference in the long term. You know, you've heard me say this before too. You probably said the same. Cybersecurity is a people business, right? So you always have to go back to the people. How do you grow the people? How do you make them better? How do you create new people that are going to make the world a better place?
Yeah, that's a wonderful sentiment. Great, great ending for us. And we'll explore that another time with you, Phil. Again, thank you for all that you've done for the country, the ecosystem. And it's been just an honor working with you over these years and being part of some of these big ideas. So we'll bring you back for another time. For our audience, thank you for your time and attention. We really, we hope to dig a little more wisdom out of some of my early generation here, and happy to warn you of traps and offer advice and see if we can provide some of that guidance that Phil talked about. So please come join us for this kind of episode and many others just like it. Subscribe to us in the usual ways, and we look forward to catching you for the next episode. Thank you all.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.